I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World, exploring the underworld of globalization, the world of refugees, with the theater director Peter Sellers. Before 26 performances of The Children of Heracles, an ancient play about refugees, I held open conversations on stage with today's refugees and asylum seekers, and also with the wide web of professionals who deal with them, immigration judges, torture monitors, human rights advocates, doctors, lawyers, Bush administration policy people. It added up to a kind of refugees 101.
Under international law, if someone leaves their country and seeks political asylum, meaning they are facing some kind of persecution, they have a realistic fear that they will be persecuted because of their religion, their race, their involvement in politics in one degree or another, then the host country has an obligation not to return them to their country of origin.
And refugees, by definition, leave their homes without documents, without anything. They can't prove who they are. In this world, not being able to prove who you are is a very difficult position.
We're living through a period that is creating different kinds of wars than we had in the past, where civilians are the target, and where one of the goals is to create refugees and to create crises.
The refugee crisis is destabilizing countries throughout the world. The countries that are the receiving countries are overwhelmed by the problems. You can imagine we had 1.5 million Afghans who fled into Pakistan. The countries can't begin to care for their own populations, and then they're impacted enormously.
You learn, for example, that 3/4 of the 30 million displaced people in the world are women and children. It's the lucky few, less than 1%, who get asylum in the United States. It takes a good lawyer, which most refugees don't have. Since 9/11, refugees can get lumped loosely with terrorists, though they're people in danger, not dangerous people.
People who are now arrive at the borders or port of entry are thrown into expedited removal, don't even come in front of the asylum corps anymore. They're stopped at the airport and they're put in detention and they're sent immediately to immigration judges.
I have to deal with INS every day, and one of the challenges is knowing how hard their job is. Now the guys who are sitting in those chairs are producing 50 decisions a day, which is to say the average life decision, whether you should live or die in this country, is 10 minutes. The time from the open your file to closing it.
It's only the lucky and the strong and the ones who can hold on to family or the ones who are phenomenally sustaining within themselves who post-war can stand on their feet and in that first generation thrive. Often it takes another generation for people to come back from being war refugees.
The American story of an immigrant coming, bringing their children, learning the language, going to school, and becoming a success within one generation or two generations, that's something we should celebrate. But we shouldn't have the illusion that that is typical for what happens to refugees in the modern world. In the modern world, the success story is when the tent has electricity and some heat.
But a refugee who does come is welcomed by an institute like ours. There are 35 partners, more than 100 agencies across the country who do this kind of work. We greet a person at the airport. We've already rented an apartment. We have food on the shelves. We have linens and beds. And we will welcome them with the assurance that they will be supported during their first months in this country. And the good news is, and I think it's one of the great success stories of America, is that we average from a person who arrives without a change of shirt to economic self-sufficiency for themselves, for their family, 4.5 months.
Another thing I learned just listening was that always there have been good refugees and bad refugees. Nowadays, exiles from Cuba can be presumed good, from Haiti, presumed bad. We see them differently, even when they look much the same. Ketna, a teenage refugee from Haiti, took the Haitian image problem head-on, speaking to a matinee audience of high school students.
At my high school, people were just talking about, did you see that Haitian people jump off the boat and kill themselves? And people were laughing and making jokes. And I was like, you think it's funny, right? You have it good here. You have a fridge full of food. You have the nice clothes, the Nike sneakers. Life is good for you. But let's think about it. Why would somebody rather kill themselves than go back home?
For Peter Sellers, it was another instance of what often happens in theater, the atmosphere of high art and personal history producing an elixir of liberation. Ketna's story was another that seemed to ease the grip of a generalized fear.
I mean, she's, again, a teenager who told a theater full of teenagers today, nothing funny about those boats being turned away full of Haitians or people jumping out of rickety boats to their deaths. And she got away with it. She transformed a television image into a kind of heart's truth, kid to kid. It was overwhelming to me.
Well, not only, it's not so much that she got away with it. What's amazing is what the American media gets away with. Kedna had the truth on her side. And the truth is always the most powerful thing on earth. You know, we're just trained to do everything we can to avoid it. And so Kedna just touched, you know, this much of the hem of the garment of truth. And the healing power was overwhelming. And suddenly that audience just sat right up. I think one of the most empowering things is the play has a very beautiful line of Iolaus, the old fighter, who says, "Very few men match their fathers today." That kind of notion that a heroic generation has passed and now there's just us. And Kedna saying that her father, when she told him that she was going to go back to Haiti this summer and do human rights work and help out at hospitals. And he said, "You're crazy, you can't go back there." And what Kedna announced to an audience of teenagers today, that she knew that she was now stronger than her father. That was powerful. And you get, you know, the great times are not gone and the great men are not passed from the earth. But the opposite, the generation on the way is going to be strong. Exactly because they've seen weakness, they've seen corruption, they've seen the absence of courage and moral clarity. And they know that it is urgent.
Peter Sellers is best known for his operas, modern and classic. For staging Mozart's Don Giovanni, for example, among drug dealers in New York's Spanish Harlem. It was 9/11 that brought him back 24 centuries to Euripides, and it was Euripides that led our conversation back to 9/11.
September 11th has been the oddest event because it's been used as a mask for so many things rather than as a revelation. And the actual outcome of American policies in this last generation where we're going to go everywhere and intervene and install democracy. You know, our record of installing democracy in Somalia, in Haiti, in Afghanistan is not impressive. You'd have to say that there's a trail of wreckage. And we have a situation where what can be said for every one of these American interventions is that group of people constitutes the largest refugee population in the world. That the Somalian refugees, the Haitian refugees, the Afghani refugees, and now the Iraqi refugees, what we have done is displaced entire populations. And we have situations now where each of these countries is uninhabitable by its own citizens. And people are living in fear every day. So that's a kind of corollary and consequence of U.S. policy that is underrepresented in the media, I think it's fair to say, and is underrepresented in the minds of most Americans because most Americans aren't thinking of consequences. They're not thinking three or four steps ahead. They're not thinking what the actual result of this action will be. And so Euripides is busy thinking several steps ahead, busy thinking several generations ahead, busy thinking, well, this action is actually going to play out on a very large canvas across a long timeline. And don't think you're just going to have your little 5 minutes of revenge and then we can say we're even, because the world doesn't work that way.
Euripides and this refugee play, The Children of Heracles, leave a key question hanging for the ages. It's the question of kinship and what it gets you. In the small world of Greece 2,500 years ago, kinship was about blood and shared battles. Heracles, Iolaus, and the Athenian president were all related, near cousins who had fought alongside each other, and the connection helped get the Children of Heracles into Athens. But in the 21st century, what are the family ties between us Americans in this nation of immigrants and the new refugees?
What's the modern version of kinship on which these refugee and obligation questions should be resolved?
Well, when Iola says that, you know, I carried Hercules' shield on the bloody expedition to bring back the Amazon Queen's belt, and Hercules, as everybody knows, saved your father from the moated depths of hell. You know, that whole question of what we did so that you people could have something, I think, you know, in a very, very simple way, you know, the White House in Washington, D.C. was built by slaves. The U.S. Capitol building was built. Two-thirds of the laborers were slaves. Their masters were paid $5 a day for their labor. They were paid nothing. If you ask, how did we get here? Ask who picked the strawberry on your strawberry shortcake tonight. Ask who made your underwear in Bangladesh or Honduras. Ask which Chinese prisoners made the shoes on your feet. Just ask who did what they did so you can be who you are and have what you have. And then say, can we live in some sense of reciprocal obligation? And right now, that is the reality of a globalized, interpenetrated world. And we only want it to go one way. And that is a big mistake. Because globalization is two-way. And that means we have to figure out how to share. We have taken a whole lot from everywhere. And at the moment, a lot of people have done extraordinary things so that we can enjoy our prosperity. That prosperity needs to be the world's prosperity. And that's the first step of the kinship of immigration. You know, we're very happy for a global capital to move with no borders. And suddenly we're stopping every human being at every border. And what most societies live with around the world, which is a non-cash economy, where the economy is sustained by giving gifts, and what people owe each other is based on exchange. One of the things we did was we said, I'm paying for this, so I don't want to know who made it. I don't want to know what they went through. I just bought it. That's all I need to know is this transaction. But in fact, every single thing in our lives has a big chain of transactions behind that transaction. And that's the karma that's coming into your life and that you're part of. And you can recognize it or not, but it's a whole lot healthier to recognize it. And again, imagine what it is that we can offer in return. And I think, as Iola says, in return, what we're asking you is not to be betrayed, not to be given back into the hands of our enemies. We have made these sacrifices so that you can be the most prosperous country in the face of the earth. Now we're asking you not to betray us.
Peter Sellers is a man who can see the darkness in the world in great detail and locate the light in it. The young refugees on his stage, in particular Ketna from Haiti and Niazi from Kosovo, he saw as heroic versions of his young self.
I'm somebody who, you know, started when I was very young, so I knew what I was going to do with my life when I was 10, and I've been doing it every day since then. And so and a lot of artists are in that state of, you know, very early on, and then you're very, very, very clearly focused. And so I'm very moved when I see another young person who already can see their life ahead of them, is preparing for it every day, knows how high the stakes are, knows it's very important not to fail, and holds their own highest standard of excellence, holds themselves to a much higher standard of excellence than the world around them.
The agony of asylum seekers, in the Peter Sellers telling, is part of replanting the best of American values in our own soil.
I'm a very, very positive person. And where we're headed is with Kent and Niazi. Where we're headed is people who have been there, done that, and truly do not want to repeat the cycle. And truly are hoping for a new century where there is a kind of evenness, you know, where an African can be equal to an American, where a Latin American can be equal to a North American. And we haven't seen that yet. And that's going to be a few generations of work, but these are the generations that are committed. My deepest sense of why we do these plays and, you know, what we're doing as artists is that we are actually creating a sense of the viability of alternatives.
Refugia, this nowhere nation, is not quite everywhere, but it's closer to all of us than we usually imagine, and it seems to be growing. If you suppose you've never met a refugee, think again about grandparents, great-grandparents. Within two generations, or three blocks, or two chairs from where most of us are now, somebody has a story of another place still pined for, or of the hard lessons on the road to this one. Tell them you want to listen. Before we go, listen to some last words this hour from the Czech novelist Milan Kundera on themes of flight, exile, nightmares, and nostalgia among refugees. This is from his new novel titled Ignorance. It involves a Czech woman, Irina, who was living in Paris in the 1990s and just aching for home in Prague after the Velvet Revolution turned the communists out. We ask the Czech actor Jan Triska, who played Aeolus in The Children of Heracles, to read it for us.
From the very first weeks after emigrating, Irina began to have strange dreams. She's in an airplane that switches direction and lands at an unknown airport. Uniformed men with guns are waiting for her at the foot of the gangway. In a cold sweat, she recognizes the Czech police. She cries out. She wakes up. Martin, her husband, was having the same dreams. Every morning they would talk about the horror of that return to their native land. Then, in the course of a conversation with a Polish friend, an emigre herself, Irina realized that all emigres had those dreams, everyone, without exception. On any given night, thousands of emigres were all dreaming the same dream in numberless variants. The emigration dream, one of the strangest phenomena of the second half of the 20th century. These dream nightmares seemed to her all the more mysterious in that she was afflicted simultaneously with an uncontrollable nostalgia and another completely opposite experience. Landscapes from her country kept appearing to her by day. Visions of landscapes would blink on in her head, unexpectedly, abruptly, swiftly, and go out instantly. She would be talking to her boss, and all at once, like a flash of lightning, she would see a path through a field. She would be jostled on a metro, and suddenly a narrow lane in some leafy Prague neighborhood would rise up before her for a split second. All day long, these fleeting images would visit her to assuage the longing for her lost Bohemia. The same movie maker of the subconscious who by day were sending her bits of the home landscape as images of happiness, by night would set up terrifying returns to that same land. The day was lit with the beauty of the land forsaken, the night by the horror of returning to it. The day would show her the paradise she had lost, the night the hell she had fled.
That was John Tryska, reading from Milan Kundera's novel, Ignorance. Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison of Transim.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kaya Wilson, Justin Grotlucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Special thanks to the American Repertory Theater. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.
Public Radio International.